And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
This week I'm Tim Callender.
I'm Jeremy Heide.
And I'm Gary from Jacksonville. How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us tonight, Gary. We appreciate it for filling in last week, such as it was.
Well, you know, I got to make up for my lack of voicemail, so.
We have had a nice, long, hopefully recuperative break. Everyone recovered?
Yes. Ready to go.
Well, they kicked me out of the Zocalo, so yeah, I'm good.
And hopefully we can jump back into our usual groove, talking about all things Babylon 5, and even some stuff Babylon 5 fans will go, what, where does that, where did you find that?
Yeah, right?
Oh, like today's book, I think we'll have a lot of fun talking about that, The Parliament of Dreams.
Yes.
Yes, for all of you true science geeks, or just sci-fi geeks in general, this is geeky, academic geeky.
Oh, you're not kidding. I wouldn't think that people could actually present new viewpoints to me about Babylon 5 that I haven't heard or thought of myself. And several times throughout reading this book, I'm like, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. Or, oh, that's so true. And it was a pleasure to read it.
Yep. But I think probably the first thing we need to talk about is the announcement made at Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con 2012, in which J. Michael Straczynski will launch a new media company, JMS Studios, to handle his output for comic books, digital media, TV series, feature films, and even video games, it says.
And also, our own Pat Tallman has a key role in it as well. She's going to be one of the, I'm not sure if it's managers or runners or what her exact term is, but I know she is a very integral part of the new studio.
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that they're planning to do with the JMS studio is to produce a movie every 18 months. So I'm kind of reading through a little write-up here. The first movie they're looking at is a film called Flickering Light, which is a fact-based film about Lenny Riefenstahl making a film that required basically actors from out of the concentration camps outside Berlin. Yeah, so it's pretty heavy stuff there. MTV.com will be doing a web series that JMS is producing, which is The Adventures of Apocalypse Al, which I'm assuming is based off this
radio plays.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the one we never got to hear.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we'll get to see them.
Wow.
But it doesn't give a date for release on either of these items. They're self-financing a second web series called Living Dead the Musical. And the other handful of things, not only is he reviving his Joe's Comics imprint with Image Comics, he's also going to be working on developing a TV series with Sam Raimi called Vlad Dracula, which is supposed to follow, I guess, semi-factual-based of the real Vlad the Impaler as he goes from benign ruler to insane despot. I don't know.
Well, at that end, it's on Stars, so that means that the some of the creative shackles will be a little bit freer. You know, nudity, cursing.
I was going to say more
gore,
blood and booze.
So. Yep.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, do you want my editorial now?
Go for it.
I am tired of vampires. Oh my god, I'm so tired. I don't care if it's real and gritty as opposed to shiny and sparkly. I'm so tired of vampires.
Well, wait a second. From what you described, it's not about vampirism. It's about the evil man whose name became synonymous with vampires, right?
Sure. Yes. However, having said that, do you think if vampires were big or weren't big that they would sign up for a project that has Dracula in the title?
Might be a little bit of a hook title.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, all right, look, they did.
And I'll watch it anyway because it's got JMS name on it. I'll give you that.
Well, I mean, look, they did they did the Tudors, they did the Borgias, they've done what's the other one? Rome. So yeah, historicals with lots of blood and gratuitous violence are popular.
Yeah, and tired of vampires.
So are you saying you would have wanted it to have been a zombie venture?
No, zombie vampires, that's what we need. Let's just roll it all into one big mess here. Anyways.
Well, let's save the horror podcast for another group of hosts here.
Yeah, zombie vampires. Wow.
Yeah. Okay, Summer, there you go. There's your next project. Start working on
it. No.
Anyways. I've also kind of been keeping tabs on some of the fan reaction here. And a lot of, you know, there are some people saying this is a wonderful thing, but plenty of people also saying, Straczynski never finishes anything. So.
He doesn't?
I think there's been a couple, and Gary, you could probably talk about this better than I, but he didn't complete his run on Wonder Woman. I think there's another
Superman, although he's still doing the larger graphic novel version, right, of Earth One.
Oh yeah, Earth One was the only one I knew about. I didn't know about Wonder Woman.
Well, yeah, he jumped. He rather abruptly ended both Wonder Woman and Superman. They was writing simultaneously. A lot of people predicted that to happen because, given the nature of those two flagship characters, it's often hard to work with editors and all the criticism that those two high-profile books can exhibit at the same time. Not that he can't write enough, but sometimes it's just constant changes, and it really is a pulse beat for DC Comics on as to how those does, especially Superman more so than Wonder Woman. So if they watch upticks and downticks of sales with a microscope, and I can imagine there was constant probably tweaking ideas being thrown at him that he got fed up with. Then there was also the case of Spider-Man, where they didn't like the direction that he was forced to go in, both through those major summer crossovers as well as actual plot changes that they wanted, and he walked from there too. Even Thor was a rather short run for him as well.
Yeah, but and in my mind, those are things that are outside of his immediate control because he's working on high profile properties.
Well, there's other independent ones that took a long time. Even Rising Stars, which I do consider to be an excellent comic book work of his, took an awfully long time to finish. To call it late would have been generous.
extended storytelling.
Yes. So I realize some cases it's the art, in some cases it's the publisher who's in no rush to publish out the extra ones until they hear an uproar enough that they know they're going to make money off doing it. But regardless, it's not without its basis to say that projects that he does announce and is excited about aren't able to come to the level of completion that he would wish they would.
That's fair enough. But when all's said and done, he completed Babylon 5 with the hard work of many other people, and we're very, very thankful for that, or else we wouldn't be here.
That's true.
So, anyways. So that, I think that's the big, big announcement there, and do wish Joe good luck with all that. So
we have one, and it isn't JMS related, so we'll just go off his wagon for a minute. Yes, I know. Bruce Boxleitner, who's been on Twitter lately, occasionally actually even answers me, which gets me excited to levels that only people I'm speaking to right now can really appreciate.
Right.
Anyway, he's working on a new series, and I'm not sure if it's direct cable or I don't believe it's network. It's called Lantern City, and it's a Western with a, as best I can tell, a steampunk flavoring, but not over-the-top steampunk. Okay. And so he's involved in that. I believe he's not only acting in it. I believe he has something to do with the production. Whether he's an actual producer or not, I'm not positive, but he's definitely working to sort of get the show running and made. So he's excited about it when it went in the few terse 140 character exchange.
Right. Well, from what little you related there, would it be fair to characterize it as perhaps an adventure series in the vein of the original Wild Wild West?
I there's not enough out there to honestly say.
Okay.
I did enjoy. Yeah, I actually have that whole series on DVD, both the black and whites and the color versions of it. And yeah, I loved that series growing up. And
wow.
It's a great show, Robert Conrad.
Oh yeah, no, it's a great show. I would never have thought to go get it on DVD.
Oh yes, yeah. The movie was a travesty, but the TV series is magnificent.
Well, so, as I recall, because I haven't seen it in years, there is a certain level of kind of that steampunky tech without it being over the top.
It was over its, yeah, exactly. It was way ahead of its time, considering the strides that steampunks made in this day and age, to remember that started in the late 60s. Yeah, so it was very much ahead of its time. I wonder if it'll get rediscovered a little bit more as steampunk continues in its popularity rise. But I got the impression there actually, you know, when it says Lantern City, it's in a town. So I don't know, travel-wise, I imagine it's got to be sort of a locale-based type of show. At least I would expect it to be.
Ooh, how about Eureka as a Western?
More information out there, but that's a nice little take, but we'll have to wait and see. But regardless, Bruce was very excited about it, and it's nice to see him excited about a project. I know he does a lot of these TV movies, and we sort of joke and chuckle about them, and I understand, you know, he needs to work, and I don't belittle any actor, you know, their livelihoods, but he actually seemed genuinely excited about this, which makes me anxious to see it. And I think it's at lanterncity.tv, I believe.
Nope, I'm looking at it right now, lanterncitytv.com.
.com, huh? So, but yeah, so take a look around. He's thrilled about it, and I know we like him in space, but he does a really good Western, too. So, you know, give him a shot, right. Definitely.
That's where he started out, so... Remember? Long time ago?
Yes, I know.
Galaxy Far, Far Away?
Yep. Which was also a Western in space.
In a lot of ways, yes. Yes. So, all right then. Well, I think that's pretty much got our open covered.
Yes. We will take a really, really quick break and come back and dive into a book that most of you have never seen or even heard of, but it's well worth the read if you can find it.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you, wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Talking Parliament of Dreams tonight The official title, the full title of the book, is Parliament of Dreams, Conferring on Babylon 5. And it actually is a collection of papers, academic papers, from a conference that was given in, what was that, 1997, I believe?
98, I think, actually. For what it's worth, as I recall reading through most of the pieces, the fourth season had aired, and if there was no announcement made about renewal for the fifth and final year, there certainly wasn't anything of any note that referred to the fifth season.
No, no matter, so. They put a significant amount of emphasis on deconstruction of falling stars in a lot of their sort of end summaries, because I guess as they wrote the papers, that was what the show had ended on.
Right. Here it is. The conference actually took place December of 97, and season 5 had been given the go-ahead but wasn't going to air in the UK for like another month and a half. So some of the papers were actually rewritten to take some season 5 happenings into account, but most of them weren't. For people who may not have noticed yet, there's a PDF in the feed that I got permission from the Science Fiction Foundation to post. It's actually the introduction to this volume. And I think it sheds a lot of light on why these people were so fascinated with Babylon 5, why they wanted to put out a call for papers for Babylon 5, and why, basically, just why. You know, like, they're all so much fascination with Babylon 5, the philosophy, the characters, the conflicts, all of it. And I think it gives a good summation of how a lot of us still feel about the show. Just, there's so much there. You will take any opportunity that you can to explore it a little more deeply.
Yep.
And if it comes from asking a bunch of professors who are also science fiction geeks to write a paper on your favorite topic on Babylon 5, then so be it.
I will say, for just general comment, well, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm the smartest guy in the classroom. Reading a number of these, I felt really, well, I'll be fair, not dumb, but certainly undereducated.
Yes.
Let's put semiotics, the word semiotics got thrown about quite freely in a number of these papers.
Philosophically outclassed is how I would put it.
That's not a bad way of putting it. And sometimes I couldn't tell whether it was me just at that point, you know, all right, I'm tired of this, you know, these guys are just flaunting their, you know, their PhDs over something as inane as a television show. But that's really kind of being unfair, because what really surprised me was, after I got past my initial reaction of, you know, like I said, the overeducation, a lot of them were fairly quick reads, if dense. And a lot of them had some of them talked about stuff that's pretty obvious. There's a paper in there about the influence of Lovecraft on the Babylon 5 universe, and mm-hmm. That to me seemed fairly obvious. Some other things, there was one, and I can't remember the title of it. It's back toward one of the later papers that basically deconstructed not the theme of the show, but the show itself, in terms of how it is a almost purely American production, in that it doesn't ever address any of the deeper politics that are implied in particular episodes, which I thought was very interesting, as these were British writers. And the episode in question, and it came up a couple, was By Any Means Necessary, which dealt very directly with labor disputes. And this particular writer took it to task because it never dealt with what he perceived to be the underlying theme of why is there labor unrest in the first place? And what does that really mean about the universe? And basically took Babylon 5 as a production to task for saying they shied away from really delving into the meat of the episode because American audiences, American production wouldn't allow it.
What?
Yeah, that's kind of what I took. What I took away from it. It's a really great show, but when it's faced with the opportunity to make some really important comment on something really vital, like, you know, the Labor Party agenda, I mean the rights of workers, it shied away. But, you know, my response to that is that's not what that episode was about.
Yeah, that episode was actually kind of a reaction to the writer's strike that had gone on just before, plus a little bit of.
Now, are you talking about the Sheridan one or the Sinclair one?
The Sinclair one. Because the other part of it is, that episode wasn't meant to address deep issues about how capitalism deals with labor unrest. It was really about people faced with the situation. And yeah, you could say that the obvious criticism is that ultimately they were really just more interested in getting the job done. And the author of the paper had a fair criticism. You know, if Sinclair was able to divert millions of credits in order to pay increased wages for the dock workers, he called into question the fact that there's a million credits sloshing around in the budget to begin with. And you know what? I can kind of understand that. But again, the whole thrust of the episode is more about Sinclair. It's really more in a sense, a character study of Sinclair as a commander. How he is able to do the right thing as he perceives it to be, while also attempting to stay within the limits of his authority as part of a institution.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the ones that was in the technology section, right?
I think it was, yeah.
Oh yeah, those I kind of glossed over because I wanted to get to the philosophy part a bit more, but that's just me. But yeah, I think I'm going to have to go back and read that because I read that one really, really fast. And I didn't pick up on that part, but I think he missed the point trying to color it with British politics rather than seeing the story for what it was.
Right.
But, you know, we do that all the time. We interpret story from our own perception of our world.
Right.
So.
And the fact of the matter is, despite however well-read and educated JMS is, he is ultimately an American writer, and that will influence the kinds of stories that are told that he writes, that he has written for his production. And there's no escaping it. You know,
right.
It's not like a right or wrong. It just is.
Right. And I really do want to find some of these academics and see if they're willing to answer a few questions or talk about any of these essays, just because I'm curious to know how have the intervening years, how has the, you know, the fullness of season 5 and the movies affected their interpretation of what they wrote, you know? Oh. Not to mention the fact that this book only contains 2/3 of the papers that were presented. I want the rest of them, damn it.
Yeah, right. Gary, from your reading of this, what is the most significant takeaway or impression that you have?
The parallels they draw that I never quite that I just sort of glanced over. Something that seems so stupid, funny, that we all laugh about, and when as I say it, everyone's going to smirk. Fasten, then zip, then fasten. You know, we all can see them sitting there in the shuttle, and you know, I don't want to talk about it.
Right.
But at the same time, do you realize that that's actually a whole time travel paradox discussion?
I remember reading that paper now.
I said,
yes.
Oh my God. I said, how can four words actually relate a whole time paradox theory in such a simple, boiled down concept? It blew my mind, and I was like, oh my gosh, that was one of those, I never saw that, and it's so there. I was like,
yeah.
That's funny. Fasten,
right. That's
zip,
that's
zip
one
fasten.
Of those where I felt like, oh boy, am I a dummy?
Yeah. It's never come up in show discussion, and I was like,
nope.
Well, this is why they're professors, I suppose.
Right.
But yeah, so that was probably one of the most interesting things that I sort of smacked my head with. Also, it was in the philosophy section that Summer said she was interested in, was this whole concept of alliances is what you need to, you know, be free and safe. And it shows in so many different ways. Early on, you know, Sheridan making friends first with Delenn to save the station, second with the League of Non-Aligned Worlds to, you know, to fight the shadows. And then finally, basically, to have peace in the universe, she has to get together everyone, including this. Oh, he has to get together everyone, Earth Force, you know, Centauri into the Interstellar Alliance. And it's all of these alliances. And they went back to discuss Kosh talking about the Centauri and the Narn.
Yes.
And they went on to this thing that says, you know, that, you know, their time has passed. Let them die. They are alone, was Kosh's quote. Boy, is he a man of few words. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
But you know, what they say is that because these two were so and sort of enwrapped in themselves for various reasons, you know, the Narns for, in a sense, you know, freedom and, you know, to not be under the Centauri's thumb, and the Centauri's feeling that they don't need anyone else in the universe because they are so magnificent, that they didn't form these alliances. And when Jakar starts to talk about that, he has to sacrifice and they have to, you know, be the security guards for Babylon 5 and give of themselves until they have nothing else to give. It's really that whole concept of alliances. The Narn can't be isolated anymore. They need help. They don't need weapons ferried to them. They need to make alliances. And this is what, that came through. Like, it was like, that's the point that Jakar realized, you know, as Kosh was talking to him about this whole alliances thing. And I was like, oh, geez, another thing I never grasped before.
Yeah, that was the whole point behind his, you know, in order to save ourselves, we must sacrifice ourselves speech that he gave to Talon.
Yeah, and they came up the interesting line from that sort of in that discussion. You know, inclusion is the solution. They say polarity is the problem. That, you know, if you're isolating yourselves, it's not going to solve anything. And then just to show the sort of that you can't be one side or the other anymore. You have to come to alliances. They said it's right there in the prologue. This was the dawn of the third age. There's not two sides anymore. This is the third.
Right.
Like, oh. Yeah. And yeah, that plays into, an essay that was in the first section, one that as soon as I started rereading it, I remembered how fascinated I was by it the first time, I don't know, what, 8 years ago when I first read it. The one about balance, where he was talking about how all of these conflicts are about polarity.
Right.
And where you have like one side against another, you've got, you know, left versus right, conservative versus liberal. On all
green
of these
purple.
Green versus purple, exactly.
No, but it is. It's the polarity and the extremism of those poles. Yeah, right.
Yeah, but they're talking about how the polarity of that is actually increases the divisiveness, the antagonistic phase, and it's not until, quote, I think he said something about you mature and you bring in the third thing, that's, you can't have balance when there's only two sides. You need a third perspective for there to be true balance. And if you look at it, you've got two sides is a pole, a straight line. You can't really balance that and have it stay in balance. But with the three sides, you have the triangle. There's a base. And then that when that whole thing when he said about the third perspective bringing balance, I'm like, okay, you've got the three casts in the Minbari structure. Everything is centered around three. There's balance there. And that directly ties into Kosh saying understanding is a three-edged sword. There's three edges. There's 3 points. 3 points of perspective bring balance to the whole situation. And I'm just like, holy crap, I love this.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's one of those things where I think some of those essays, what was really interesting is it crystallized some of those nebulous awarenesses that I might have had. You know, to your point, Gary, you know, I think one point Delenn talks about in one in an episode, I'm going to say it's somewhere in the fourth season, and the episode title kind of escapes me at this point. But she talks about the strength of the human is that they build communities. But the authors, given that they are of an academic bent, have the ability to describe in very vivid detail those things that I am kind of aware of, but not really able to articulate. And that's one of the things, in terms of what the volume provides, that's one of the things that's very interesting about that book.
Yes, that's exactly it. They describe certain concepts that we have talked about for several years. We have an intuitive understanding of what's going on, but not the depth of experience in that field to give it proper voice, I guess.
Is that what semiotics means? Because I've never really looked it up. I just kind of like, all right.
That's okay, because I was looking down. I don't remember which essay it was, but this the one guy, he pulled out all of these quotes from the various novels. I'm like, oh my God, where did you find that?
I remember reading that, and I thought it was very interesting reading that particular essay, because he pulls quotes out of what are considered
non-canonical material.
And so it's like, and there's that part of me as the B5 purist that has to kind of wrap my head around just the fact that this guy is using this material to work out his thesis.
I just felt bad he had to read the books.
Right. There's that too. Yeah.
But you have to wonder, it's like, well, the people, the authors who wrote this book, the books, how much more spot on are they than we have given them credit for in before, that he's using examples of what they've written to better illustrate some of the points he's making. I'm like, wait a second.
Well,
I mean, the stories might not be as cohesive or as entertaining or as exciting as we like, but maybe the characterizations aren't as off as we thought.
I don't know. I mean, that's a whole other discussion in itself.
Which we'll probably get to next week or the week after.
Right, exactly.
But, that being said, don't forget that these, in a sense, these people are working off sort of in a blind from our point of view at this point, too. You do have to accept this, that most of these papers did not have any exposure to a fifth season. They didn't have the benefit of, I didn't really see them make much reference of JMS's, news postings either.
Couple of them did. A couple of them mentioned some of his commentary on, well, on the Lurker's Guide, not so much the news postings.
And they tipped Andy Lane a lot, and if I recall some of our conversations earlier in our show with Jeffrey, a lot of that stuff isn't quite
quite accurate.
So,
that's another thing I want to get into, but we can get into it deeper later. There's two books that Andy Lane wrote, and supposedly the first one is okay, but the second one is kind of questionable. Is that what the deal is? Because I avoided both of them just because of seeing some really, really negative feedback.
The first one was shaky, and the second one was earthquake. Of course, okay. Did write the introduction for the second one that I read on the show, so, you know, And even he dismisses the book, and he wrote the introduction for it. So,
yep.
But that being said, they also didn't have access to the script books or the hundreds of pages that JMS has written about every episode at this point that we have what his thoughts actually were. You know?
And maybe that might not be a bad thing because, you know, we've seen from the B5 scrolls that some people say, well, wait, that's a little bit of revisionist history there. Hang on. This is what happened during this part. So, and one of the essays actually mentions promotional material that was sent out in 1991 describing the characters. And it sounds like they were describing an early version of the writer's Bible.
Right. Right. I remember reading that as well.
And I just don't know. They didn't have a whole lot of detail on what was in there, but they talked about the original gender disguise for Delenn and a couple of other things about one of the other characters. I think they even named one of the alien races wrong. Because I had to read that. They called them the Galian. And then I read that section again. I'm like, oh, they're talking about the game. What? Yeah. Where'd that come from?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that your comment there about Delenn's gender, that reminded me of one of the essays that got to talking about the alien and the other, mm-hmm. and touched on some gender politics, which I thought was kind of fascinating. There was a couple. It was an interesting duality because there's an essay toward the beginning of the book, and again, I don't remember which section, in which the author praises the reinvention of what it means to be an action hero and what it means to be female.
Yes.
And she discusses how in Babylon 5, many of the female characters are in roles that are not considered traditional women's roles. In other words, they're not nurturers. They're not necessarily mother figures. Delenn mm-hmm. is a high-ranking member of the super secret Grey Council. Susan Ivanova is second in command of the station. The only one who might fall into that would be, and now here I'm kind of paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly how she addressed it, but Talia/Lita were more, you know, that sort of the traditional victim, but Lita certainly becomes something more than that. You know, and we can only speculate as to what was supposed to happen to Talia before, her Andrea Thompson's abrupt departure from the series.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, the funny thing is that essay, in the introduction, they describe as one that they solicited after, because the initial paper that was going to deal with gender, the Garibaldian masculinity one, the guy couldn't go to the conference to present it. So they actually solicited this essay after the fact to include it in the collection.
And here's what's really interesting is because by the same token, there's another essay which talks about the alien and the other, and goes on to point out, and this is what's your comment about Delenn's gender is what spurred my memory here, is that this author points out that he points out that Sheridan dies to become a god in essence. And this author says, well, he gets to do that because he's male. Delenn undergoes a transformation, and she loses status. Now, I don't necessarily agree with this author's assessment of that, but he points out that Delenn then becomes Sheridan's partner. She doesn't operate from a position of strength, which again, I don't agree with. But he goes on to point out, you know, that's where he sees a gender bias in Babylon 5. But I hope I'm speaking of the right essay, but he also talks about the degradation of Susan Ivanova with the heinous boom shabalaba scene from Acts of Sacrifice.
Yeah, well, no. And see, I think he was he wasn't talking about that it was heinous from a woman having to perform that. He was, let me be blunt here, he was pissed that Straczynski would stoop so low to put typical sci-fi tropes and something as magnificent as Babylon. I mean, he was pissed about a couple of things in there. He says, how dare you be just plain ordinary and use these same tired old tropes?
Right. You're right. Yes.
I remember, because I was reading that part, I'm like, really? You totally missed the point of Boom Shabalabala, didn't you?
That's exactly what I'm thinking, too. If anything else, that was a prime example of a female character taking control of the situation.
Right. What was she supposed to do? Sleep with that loser?
Well, I mean, you know, that's exactly right. And the whole thing is summed up at the end. What happens now? Well, old style, you roll over, go to sleep. New style, you say, you'll call me and I never see you again. Or, you know, you go out for pizza, I never see you again.
Right.
And the ambassador just go like, I'll call again. Walked off. It's like, I'm with you. I'm with you, Summer.
I mean, yeah, that's
the essay. I'm like, going, dude, you missed the whole point of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I jump for a second. I think we missed part of the whole Lita discussion, and it's that they're saying that much like Delenn was partnered with Sheridan, and that's how she was successful in a sense. They also talk about Lita pairing up with Kosh, and that's one of the things that sort of got her, you know, status up as well. She wasn't sort of self-made, say like Ivanova, or you know, was.
Summer, I think that's essay more than any would be an interesting one to revisit in light of what happened in the fifth year. Because one of the things that I see, you know, examining it from light of the fifth season, you. Delenn may be Sheridan's partner, but she's an equal partner. She has as much weight and authority as Sheridan.
Was that the very, very last one?
No, it's earlier in the book, because I didn't unfortunately get to read the last couple essays that are in there. And I made audio notes on my phone and I forgot to access it.
All right, well, we can take a really quick break, and then we can come back and talk about a couple of the other things. And I do want to go down the list of the table of contents so people know some of the stuff that we're talking about. So let's take a really quick break right now, and we'll come right back.
Brian is snarky and Brett never reads. Our Nigel Blackwood blows them both in the weeds. Skiznot and Megan the Bionic Geek. These are the folks that we hear every week. Tim with his handguns and his silly hats. Sam wears her sandals, stilettos, and flats. Trouble is lovely in her little horns. Mike's drinking scotch watching parody porns. We are Slicers. We love sci-fi. It's really rad. Just simply donate to Slice of Sci-Fi. Then you will feel so glad.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Hola y saludos a todos. Healthy que vacío que orden.
SliceofSciFi.com.
And we're coming back. I have to thank Jeremy for getting us back on the rails, because we started talking about
yes, we started having the show stuff outside the show.
And aha, found it. All right, go ahead, you guys.
All right, Gary, you started to make reference about the time travel paradox, potential closed loop or not, regarding the one singular time travel bit that this series had. So go ahead, go.
Well, in this book, there's a multi-page discussion about time travel and how you can have, in a sense, different timelines. And it basically shows, when they're talking about Babylon Squared, how you did actually have multiple timelines. You had the call from Ivanova about the station getting blown up and attacked. You see the flashbacks for Garibaldi defending as the incursions are happening to the station. And but none of that stuff ever actually ended up happening. So it makes me wonder if Babylon 5 really is a closed loop system. If Sinclair goes back in time, will we get the identical, you know, 1,000 years that preceded this current timeline? I don't think we could actually say that at this point. I used to think we did, and yes, we have little things like the letters that come through to both, you know, Sinclair in the current time as well as Delenn. But at the same time, it's not necessarily a fixed system, because we've shown it's not, because of the Ivanova distress call. So it makes me wonder if how much actually did happen the way it was supposed to happen.
Okay, so now to go completely on a tangent, have you read the David Gerald's not time travel novel, The Man Who Folded Himself?
Yeah, that's where he like meets himself, I think. And
right, stuff. And the premise is basically this: that when you jump through time, you're never jumping through different points on timeline A. What you're doing is jumping to a parallel point on timeline B. And then when you jump through time again, you are now at that point on timeline C. And in essence, you can never go home again.
But isn't that what Babylon 5 says, that he does go into their actual past? So he's staying on timeline A the whole time?
Well, that's what our assumption is. But as you've just pointed out, Gary, there's other evidence that indicates perhaps not.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. From where you are in point A, because we had, who was it? It was Lady Morella, or was it Lady Ladira, who said it's one possible future? From where you are, certain things still have not happened yet. So those future actions may or may not happen. So from your point of view, the past is fixed, but the future is fluid. So what, I mean, Garibaldi was seeing
was... always in motion
was,
the future is.
Yes, always in motion the future is. But so what Garibaldi was seeing was, he says, I've seen Babylon 5 destroyed 8 times now, and it's always been the same, because from his point of view, they haven't yet gone back in time to save Babylon 4 and send it back where it was needed. And that future will not become set for their timeline until they actually go do that.
I think of it in terms of not a closed loop, but think of like a loop on a string.
Mm. In other words, I'm talking the Sinclair story. Story is a closed loop.
Right, exactly. Yes, right. But until the events of Sinclair's loop happen, a certain perception happens to our characters along that timeline.
Right.
Because the point is, even though Sinclair is traveling, quote unquote, 1,000 years into the past, the fact of the matter is that in a very real sense, what he does 1,000 years ago is contemporaneous to what is happening with our characters in the year 2260.
Right. But technically those things can't happen until his character in the past goes to the past. His character in the present goes to the past to actually do those things. So until he leaves the timeline and goes back, the future, you know, literally from there forward is still fluid. They could either succeed or fail. But until he goes back in time, that's when everything, the number of potential future timelines consolidates. And it doesn't diverge into the one where Garibaldi saw Babylon 5 destroyed.
To quote the wisdom of Susan Ivanova, I'll be in the car.
Yes. Okay. Now we were talking about the person who was offended about the Boomshaka. That's actually in the Lovecraft essay.
Is it?
It's at the end of the Lovecraft one.
What a weird place for that. I didn't remember that it was.
That the sound that Cthulhu makes? Boom shakalaka.
I mean, he
at the dating chat room, Dread Cthulhu sleeps waiting for someone to click on his profile.
Yes, to paraphrase here, Babylon 5 is humanist, openly avowing cultural relativism, but it is cultural relativism of a particular kind. It can be sentimental, even sloppy. And that's where he gets upset at a few, things. I thought this was the one where they were talking about, where somebody compared the Zarg with Alien, and I'm like, what movie were you watching?
Yeah. No, the Zarg was not like Alien at all.
Nope. Okay. So here's there will be a link to this. There is a link in the show notes, the episode where I sent out the PDF of the intro. The SF Foundation actually has a table of contents of this book online. And it's broken into four sections: narratives, echoes, technologies, and moralities and faiths. And like I said, my favorite ones are in narratives, echoes, and morality and faiths. The narrative ones, the first two, are actually about time travel. I mean, they take time travel and they twist your brain up. I think that's the one where Gary you were saying about they had the images of the paper and the spaces in between, talking about the parallel.
About planes of time, yeah.
Right. You know, planes of time, parallel universes. I'm like, what the owl brain? And the echo section is really interesting because they talk about the effect of other literature on the myth that Babylon 5 has become, or the myth that Babylon 5 was building. And Moralities and Faiths talks about, well, the various philosophies. Well, I shouldn't say the various philosophies, several various philosophies. And I think my favorite one in that was Religion, Philosophy, and the End of History. That one and the Philosophy of Balance, which was in the narrative section, were the two that resonated with me the most, that I would go back. And one of those had the list of footnotes where I'm like, I'm going to have to check some of these things out. There's the gender one you were talking about is called Reconsidering Gender and Heroism.
Yeah.
And The Psychological Significance of Straczynski's Universe. How's that for a title?
I think that's one of those, if I recall correctly, that's one where they analyze the show as a show and not more of how the show itself fits into the culture in which it was created, in which it resides, as opposed to an examination of the elements, the thematic elements that made up the story.
Yes.
If that's the one I'm thinking of. Now, yes.
Anyone who uses Carl Jung's Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, to explain a theme in Babylon 5, dude, props.
Well, what is it? They also linked, what was it, the third principle of sentience being self-sacrifice with Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative. I was like, oh my God.
Right, yeah.
I said, how many hours we have had to gone on with the show? Probably more than the number of shows we had to ever come up with that.
Hey, we've already more than doubled the number of episodes that were in the series, so I think we're right up there.
Yeah, yeah. Although can't say that we've ever. No. I think I once sang most of the Bruce's Philosopher song, so we did have an Immanuel Kant reference on the show. So we're
okay. We're good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone.
Now, Gary, the other thing that Gary mentioned during the break, and I want to hear his thoughts about that. You mentioned Gary that the essay that had the least impact on you was Lovecraft piece. Summer, what's the title on that again?
The title on the Lovecraft one is, where is it? The Shadows Out of Time, Lovecraftian Echoes in Babylon 5. And that's in the theme and myth section, Echoes. And I thought this was the same Andy Sawyer who had been emailing back and forth with, because I asked him, like, would you be interested in talking with us about your essay? He's like, not really.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
Well, so, it discusses, some of the creatures, and, of course, it goes into, shadows and Vorlons and their equivalent of elder gods and not, but it just didn't seem to be anything more than just a simple comparison to me. And to be honest, to have this article without, what was it? Not Well of Souls. That's Crusade. Without which movie was it? The Lovecraftian.
Oh, River. Third Space.
Was
much
without
more Lovecraftian. Yeah.
Third Space just seemed it didn't seem to be relevant enough without having that in there, because that is the Lovecraftian Babylon 5, and you don't have any mention of it. I realize it wasn't probably didn't.
I'm pretty sure that Third Space did not exist when these papers were written. Not yet.
True, but I see Lovecraftian and I expect to see Third Space comparisons up the wazoo, and I didn't see it.
That's only in hindsight, because he was talking more about the effect of the shadows, because there's one passage in there. Where is it? Where the frig is it?
They did mention absolutely,
damn it. There was one point where he quoted something out of one of Lovecraft's books, and it applied directly to, what mankind is in for once we step out of our little sandbox. Where is it?
I think ultimately
he's talking about how, like, the dark ancient ones, there is no good, there is no evil, there just is, and we aren't ready for those realities yet. Here it is. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black eras of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but someday the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. And that's from Call of Cthulhu.
Yes. Which is interesting to know. One of the things that it reminded me, I've read some Lovecraft, I'm not a huge fan. Lovecraft stuff was, in a way, much more science fiction than horror. It was really more about things from outer space that were just beyond our, as you read in that passage, our ability to understand. And the understanding of that is what drove us mad, because we just couldn't comprehend it. It wasn't like a Stephen King horror or anything like that. And I think over time it's been, interpreted in stories written in the mythos, take it more toward the realm of horror. Now, having said all that, the thing that I, the reason I have sort of a meh reaction to that is, unlike some of the other essays that we've discussed at length tonight, this one seemed to just kind of be revisiting the obvious. You know, I didn't come away from reading it like I really, like I gained any particular insight in the same way that the Fast and Zip is the microcosm of, you know, causal time loops or whatever. I didn't have, even though, you know, I disagree with the author, I understand, hey, I can see why a writer might take Babylon 5 to task for not dealing with the underlying issues of labor unrest as opposed to blah, blah, blah. You know, that's all intellectual stuff. This was, to me, this was a, you know, yeah, I understand that the Vorlons and the Shadows are representative elder gods. It's not, you know, you're not telling me anything that is particularly insightful or new. And that's why I think that one, for me, was the most disappointing in the book.
The one thing that I did come out of the Lovecraftian essay about was, I had never made connections between the names of some of the characters in B5 with some of Lovecraft's characters. Never, ever put any of that together before.
Which one specifically? Because I don't remember now those details.
Well, the one that stands out was the connection of Brother Edward in passing through Gethsemane, how the characters, when he was a serial killer, his name was Charles Dexter, but when he was mind wiped, his name was Edward. And there's a character in one of the stories, his name is Charles Dexter Ward.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that.
And then
now,
he made the connection between Zach Allen and Zadok Allen. And I'm like, what? Where'd you get that from? But I guess it works. But yeah, no, I think I really do think my favorite one is the philosophy of balance.
I think that the two discussing the time travel aspect were the most whiz bang for my buck. They talked about, you know, it's the first two articles about Babylon Squared and War Without End. It just made me really think about some of the, you know, some of those aspects that I never occurred to me, and it gave me the most whiz bang for the buck. However, the one that made me actually spit out my drink as I was reading it was, if you go to page 159, and it says, just to read the last thing, by hypothesis, those habits might not be disagreeable or offensive to that species, but they might still conclude that they were wrong. Perhaps that's what Shadows and Vorlons must essentially do. Like E. Smith's Edorians and Arisians. And I thought to myself, how do I get a Lensman reference right there on the
And I had nothing to do with it.
Lensman reference right there.
Lensman reference right in the middle of the essay. Oh, so we get... Literally, we cannot escape Tim's obsession with Straczynski doing Lensman. I didn't even put that together. That's awesome.
Yes, so that was, I laughed quite out loud. The person that was next to me on the plane while I was reading it, obviously, she had gone mad.
Oh, goodness gracious, that's hilarious. That is hilarious. Now, before I read this, do we have any more to talk about from this book other than saying, I really, really, really want to read the other essays that were presented at this conference, and I would really like to find out if any of these academics would like to put these essays online so everyone else can read them?
That's, you know, I think that's kind of the shame of it, is that this is some really good material, and there is, people, there are geeks of all stripes who would enjoy reading these sorts of things. And I don't know how you get them online without begging and pleading and say, please let us do this.
Yeah, I'm literally, it could be something for me to do once, you know, the show is done. Just start an email campaign, track these people down and say, hello, I am a sci-fi geek like you are. I'm begging. And just do that. Right. But I have to wonder, have other pop culture slash sci-fi academic conferences run into the same thing. Because if I remember correctly, there were 3 or 4 academic conferences in England just on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Wow.
Yeah. Like 4 years, four different years. I don't think it was every year. I think it was like the first two were every year and then the next two were every other year. I'm not sure how much of my memory is correct on that, but the first two were like 3 days long. That's how many papers they had just on Buffy. 4 years of academic conferences on Buffy. Could have been more. I don't know. It was just those 4 years in England. I'm sitting here going, wow, they got an academic conference on Buffy multiple times? That's awesome.
Well, they all have something to do.
Oh.
It was all just shipper stuff about her and Angel, so, you know.
No, actually, it was a lot of really deep stuff. Most of it talking about Joss Whedon's tendency to A, empower strong women characters, and B, show that no one is safe. And Neil just posted a link, a Wikipedia link to Buffy Studies in the chat room. Yay. But yeah, there was, I remember like one quote from Joss Whedon. Somebody asked him, it's like, why do you keep writing stories that have like strong women characters? And he says, because you have to ask that question.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like, Joss Whedon really is my master now. But here's the last page of the collection. It's actually about the Science Fiction Foundation. The Science Fiction Foundation was founded by the late George Hay, and the patrons were Sir Arthur C. Clarke and Ursula K. Le Guin.
Wow.
Yes. The Science Fiction Foundation was created in 1970 with the aims of promoting a discriminating understanding of the nature of science fiction, of disseminating information about science fiction, of providing research facilities for anyone wishing to understand science fiction, and of investigating the usefulness of science fiction in education. Okay. Then they have a paragraph about the journal, which is Foundation, which is an awesome book if you ever get a chance to grab a copy or two. And then it says, the Science Fiction Foundation has also built up one of the finest libraries of science fiction in the world and the largest in Europe. It contains books, journals, magazines, fanzines, and manuscripts, and audio and video material. That whole thing about fanzines and manuscripts there, that's just awesome. The collection is now curated by the University of Liverpool and is open to anyone with an interest in science fiction.
Road trip.
Seriously.
Yeah, right.
I know where I'm retiring. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, Gary, next time you're over in the UK, you're going to stop by the University of Liverpool?
I will probably get there. When I was originally trying to find the book, they did mention that there is a copy available for perusing if I'm there.
I would love to just browse what they have in the library, just find out what they have. Because there are a whole lot of science fiction fanzines that have been out of print for decades, and if they have any of them, that would blow my mind personally.
It would be quite a collection to see, absolutely.
Yes. So yes, that is the mandate of the Science Fiction Foundation. It really is a shame that A, this book didn't contain all of the essays presented at that conference, and B, you can't get this book anymore unless you
beg, borrow, or steal it,
rent a kid out as farm labor for a summer. or something. It's like, I'll let you have my second oldest kid for 6 months if you let me,
All right.
Yes. So like I said, if you have any questions about this book, I will do what I can to answer them since I have a copy. Jeremy also has a copy, Lucky Dog. Like I said, he managed to luck upon one. I think I got one of the last free range copies because it was sitting there waiting for me on Amazon UK. And if I'd been thinking straight, I would have bought two of them.
That was going to be my question for you, Summer. How available is a copy if someone wanted to get out and snag one?
It's not.
It's not anymore. When I got them, there were, I think, two copies left on Amazon UK. And one was new, one was used. And just because I opted for the new one, and it wasn't that bad at the time because it cost me $40, including shipping from the UK. And considering that I've heard of copies being for sale on eBay for as high as $150, yeah.
Wow. I'm so glad that I have a friend who has a copy who was able to loan it to me that I could read it.
And Jeremy's closer. You could actually borrow his copy and, you know, get it back to him faster.
Yeah, there's that.
I didn't mean that to sound like quite as pointed. I really didn't. That was kind of funny.
No, but it was funny.
Yeah, it was fun. Actually, I did send it to Gary initially because I wasn't sure if I was going to be homeless or not last year. And that was probably one of the few things that I didn't want to get lost. So I said, here, keep this for safekeeping for the time being. And then when my situation stabilized...
She says keep it safe, but she gave me some specific instructions as if the spine were bent, I would pay. So
I don't know what it is about me and books, but I hate it when people literally crack the spine open so they can read a book. I don't care if you do it to your book. It hurts me to see you do that to your book. But if I lend you a book and you do that, I will break your knuckles.
Oh yeah,
I mean that to me is sacrilege.
That's disrespect.
That's disrespectful of a book. I lent. Here's an old story. Totally off tangent. I mean, we're not even tangenting. We're way off base here. Long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, a good friend of mine worked for Steve Jackson Games back when they were still just, you know, starting out. This was in the mid '80s.
Right.
He knew I was an avid fan of Robert Adams' Horse Clan series. Most of the early books were out of print. He couldn't find one. And he said, you know, Steve Jackson Games is looking to do a Horse Clans module. And could you lend me a couple of them? He says, well, I said, sure, no problem. So I loaned him the first book, which, by the way, was not available to buy another copy of. Okay. He gives it back to me a couple weeks later, and there's this long crease down the middle of the spine. And I just looked at it, and I'm like, what did you do to my book? And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, there's a crease down the spine of my book. What did you do? and he demonstrated on one of his books. And if I had been smart, I would have noticed his books before I loaned him mine.
Yeah.
He's one of those people that would take a paperback and actually fold the left side around
to
read the right side. So he'd have the book open, normal, to read the left page, and then fold the other side around to read the right page. So I'm like, what? You... And so the book is cracked, completely cracked.
That's and insane. I said,
I'm like, how in the world can you do that to a book? And he's like, well, aren't all, I'm like, and he's like, I thought, was this new? I'm like, no, it wasn't new. I've had that book for years. And he's like, how do you read a book and not crack the spine? I'm like, very simple. You have your middle fingers on the spine supporting it, and you have your thumbs hold the pages open.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, how did you learn how to read a book? And he could tell that I was getting more and more angry. And I had a reputation for being a hothead back then, not to mention the fact that I was a regionally ranked brown belt. Like, I beat people up on weekends for money and trophies. So he was like slowly backing away. And I said, "You realize I can't get another copy of this book." And he's like, "Please don't kill me." But long story short, I got a free set of Steve Jackson GURPS Horse Clans books out of the deal, which I still have over there. So I think there's like two or three books, maybe just two books in the GURPS Horse Clans universe. So I got a couple of those. But yeah, don't hurt my books. I would much rather buy you your own copy, which is what I did with the Matador trilogy and Heroes Die. Wonderful book. Rekindled my faith in fantasy fiction in 1999. Heroes Die by Matthew Stover. Ding. Big plug there. Go get it. Your life will never be the same.
All right. But
I think we...
You feel better
we,
now?
Yes, I do. Okay. I think we've talked about as much as we can about Parliament of Dreams. I just hope I'm equally up to the task for the non-canonical novels next week.
Yes.
All right.
I'm so sorry that other people will be joining you for the podcast for those. I so wish that I could be here to discuss those wonderful novels with you.
Well, it's funny you say that, Gary.
Yeah, you can join us if you want. That means you'll have to read seven books next week.
I'll probably have to take the Asimov over some to Epsilon 9 or something.
Gotcha. Well, yes, I guess that will do it for this show. I think we went a little long, but you know what? We had fun, damn it. Cause this book is well worth it. If you manage to find a copy, I would highly suggest getting it.
And if not, check the intro that Summer posted that gives a reasonable summary of the book. And I believe that also has a little bit of discussion of the
conference itself, yes. Is that it, Gary?
Oh, there was a Lensman reference on page 5. I completely missed
it. Right. Oh, Gary, okay.
Remember the conversation we were having about closed time-like loops in the universe? Just now is the time when I have to reveal that I went into the past and
edited that in.
Yeah, right. I did, just for
all
you.
All right. Jeremy, you have a homework assignment. Go through the book, find out exactly how many Lensman references there are just to, make Tim happy. But that'll do it.
Yeah.
Do it for this episode. Oh, my goodness. As always, the website is BabylonPodcast.com. Come by, leave us some comments. The site has a slightly new look if you haven't seen it in a while. All fresh and shiny. And you can also send in an email. BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. You could also email in a voice message if you want to record your own. Forums are out there somewhere. Farpointforums.com. They should be still out there. I don't know if they recovered the 2 years of data.
They're back up. No, I don't think we recovered the data. Many things that did not happen at Sector 20.
okay, many things happened. Was it a sector? Was it 83 by 9 by 12? Are gone now because it never happened. And as usual, the voicemail number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year a lot of really, really smart people showed us how much we really, really didn't know.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.